Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right about the, you know, the way that cinema reflects the time, and you know, it would be interesting to see this period. And it's also interesting, and actually this comes up in one of the films we're going to review tonight, about the way in which technology has affected storytelling in a very literal, in a very kind of literal sense, because the devices, and by which I mean the sort of techniques that filmmakers and storytellers would have used, they now have to, if they want to make a film or tell a story in the modern age, they have to obviously incorporate technology, which throws up loads of obstacles, because it's like, you know, for example, we're going to be doing a couple of horror films in this in this episode, that horror is one of those things where everyone watching it just goes, oh, well, I would just do this. And if you've got like a mobile phone, you're going to go, well, you kind of would have got away out of that troubled situation.
I know. It's been almost been too wise, though, isn't it? You know, it's, I mean, as critics, we're there to sort of analyze things a bit more closely and think, right, how well does that hold together? But it can go to another extreme, though, can't it, as well? You know, and that's what's interesting about it. But I've always been very ambivalent about new technology and the way films are made, because special effects are there to enhance the story but not dominate it. And that's always been my bugbear about effects and technology in films.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that is also really impacting the industry that we're seeing, because funny enough, the quality of the films that we're watching and reviewing tonight, especially the shorts, has really gone up. Because I've been doing this now for about 10 years in terms of doing the indie film reviews. Yeah. And the standard is so high now of short films, and the slickness of the production, and you know, it before you really could tell if someone was an amateur filmmaker. Like now I'm like, this looks like it was made by, like, you know, Scorsese or something.
I know. Well, you see the thing is now they don't look like indie films anymore. You know, we all have an understanding of what we mean by indie, by an indie band or an indie film, that it's very rough and ready, it's basic, it's raw, but it's got something going for it. But even what we would call indie films now are becoming very polished, I think.
Yeah, I think it's becoming difficult, you know, to know, isn't it? Yeah. Like when you see something so polished that you're like, well, the reason why they weren't polished before was because they were independent of the studios who had all the money, who were making them look slick. Yeah. But now anyone can make a film look pretty slick if they've got access to the internet. And but funny enough, I mentioned Scorsese, and he is where we're going to kick off the episode in just a second. But if this is your first time to UK Film Club, just want to say a quick hello and welcome.
Hello.
If you are new to the format, the way it works is Brian, my lovely assistant, is going to be reviewing the films at the cinema. Then we're going to do a streaming pick. So that's a film that is on a streaming platform, followed by that will be our reviews of some indie films. Now, these are films that people have specifically sent us to review. They've actually asked us to review these ones. And then we finish up with a film called The Nostalgia Pick. Now, The Nostalgia Pick is one where it's from, we're not really setting a firm rule, but it has to be at least, say, 10, 15 years old or more. As this is our October episode, we are going to be doing a horror film. But before that, we're going to get to Scorsese's latest film. And I'm going to read the IMDb title on this, because as Brian knows, I keep getting the title of this completely wrong.
Easy done.
It's not killer flowers of the moon.
Close.
Or flower moons of the killers. It is Killers of the Flower Moon. Over to you, Brian.
That's the one. That's the chappie. Yeah, okay then. So this is the much anticipated new film directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, and Lily Gladstone. So what's the story? Well, it's about Ernest Burkhart. He returns home from the First World War and joins his uncle, William King Hale. His uncle assumes the role of benefactor to a native Red Indian tribe known as the Osage. He ingratiates himself and learns to speak their language, but has a secret agenda to gain control of the tribe's wealth. Hale encourages Ernest to get friendly with Molly Kyle, an Osage whose family owns most of the oil land rights. A romance eventually develops and they are married. So, it's a good film. A very good film. It's Scorsese, it's De Niro, it's DiCaprio. That might be all you need to know. But I'm not sure why it's won so many plaudits. The length of this film just drains the energy. It's 3.5 hours long. To watch this film at the cinema, you need to block out the best part of the day. You include the trailers, you're talking about 4 hours sitting still. Right now, it's interesting because some slots offer you a 15-minute break in between. I didn't go for that because I thought, I don't want to be there for another 15 minutes, even if I do get the chance to stretch my legs. But I think it is a major issue. The film's beautiful to look at. Scorsese puts poetry on screen, just like Coppola does. The storyline's fairly predictable. You know what's happening and why. But honestly, I can think of at least 5 Scorsese movies that are better than this. But it is very good because it's got that brand. It's got that mark of quality that we always refer to, don't we? That reference point, Scorsese, Coppola, Spielberg. And I think we need to add Christopher Nolan to that list now. That have that mark of quality, you know it's going to be good. But not one of his best, in my opinion.
Wow. I mean, because I've been hearing a lot of hyperbole when it comes to this film, a lot of sort of big quotes. But when I sort of watched the trailer and stuff, I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, it looks like a Scorsese film. But the plot of it felt, it was riffing on some films that have been done before. The length did concern me. What was the film you did with the aging thing where he aged Robert De Niro?
Oh, The Irishman.
The Irishman. I've been watching that. I did that in one go. I say one go. I did it with pauses. I didn't do my over a couple of nights. I had to pause a couple of times, but I did do it all in one sitting. And I did, he is a very, very good filmmaker. It's pure cinema. But I do find it funny with these films that are coming out of late that do seem to be pushing this very, very long time frames to go almost as a, what was, almost to sort of compete with the Marvel films, the films that he is so against when he does his promos. It's almost to go, look, we can make cinema long if that's what you want. It's like, well, that isn't really what people want with the superhero stuff. It's just it just happens to be long, I think, because they're often trying to do a whole comic book, which is like a long story into one film, whereas if you're making a story specifically for film, you can make it 2 hours. Like, that's, you can tell it in 2 hours. Do you feel this film could have been told in 2 hours?
Easily, no question. You could lop over an hour off this film. Easy, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, if you'd been a bit more ruthless with the editing, it could have been an even better film. You know, as I say, not one of his best. Look, let's give you a comparison. Compare it to Goodfellas. That was on Saturday night. I came in quite late. And I came there, been on for about 20 minutes, and I sat there and watched the whole thing again for the 200th time. But that's only 2.25 hours, Chris, right? And it shows you can tell a very complex, engrossing story in literally a fraction of the time. And it's just, you just don't need it. You really don't. You know, what I think was interesting is when the Irishman was released, in interviews, were very careful about raising the subject with De Niro. But he softened up and he said, oh, okay, yeah, it's all right. If you want to sort of leave the film for half an hour to stop it, then go back to it, that's all right. He didn't mind, but it took a long while to sort of even bring the likes of Scorsese and De Niro around to the idea that maybe this is a little bit too long and maybe it borders on self-indulgence. But
I thought also, like, you don't want it to become an endurance test of, like, can you put up with a film for that long? Because, not being funny, I have needs. I have toilet needs that, you know, I have to go. I've had this before. I've been in films before where I've needed a toilet, and all that's happened is I've not focused anything on the film. I'm just thinking about, how can I get out of here? How can I go to the loo? Oh my God, I'm in so much pain. And you don't want to, you know, and I think, you know, that's important for people to know, especially filmmakers that are doing this regularly. Like, I understand if maybe you've got that one film where you're just like, look, do you know what? It just wasn't possible to cut it down. But he's doing this on the regular, and because you mentioned Nolan with Oppenheimer, that was another long one, right? Oppenheimer was like,
that was only 3 hours.
Only
3 hours, mind you. Be fair.
Did you feel that could have lost an hour as well?
Strangely enough, no. I think maybe half an hour for Oppenheimer. I mean, I still think with Oppenheimer they kind of condensed two separate stories there, and I still think that. But I think that was probably 2.5 hours, you know, because they're trying to cram so much in. But you see, Killers of the Flower Moon doesn't justify that amount of screen time, right? It's not necessary to commit that much screen time. You need to justify it. Explain why it needs that amount of time, airtime. It's just not necessary, and it harms the film, because it is a lovely film to look at. I mean, the storyline in Killers of the Flower Moon isn't particularly involving or challenging in any way. It's not constantly going off at tangents that keeps you awake. It doesn't. You know what the story is. Within 10 or 15 minutes, you know exactly what's going to happen. You know what's driving the main characters, what their motivation is, right? So you don't need any further explanation. But, you know, it's still a good film, but it's just so annoying because you can't concentrate for that amount of time, really. Some people can, but most people can't.
There we go. We'll find out. Anyone that's seen it, do let us know what you thought.
Definitely.
I know, obviously, we focused quite a lot on the runtime, but I do think, as I said, you know, when Scorsese's making a film, everyone's going to watch it because it's just, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, Chris does. Absolutely. Well, one of the all-time great directors. He's still good. It's not like he's kind of lost interest and he's going through the motions. You can see how much care and attention goes into every single frame, which is the sign of a great director.
There we go. So that's Killers of the Flower Moon. I just had to double check that I said that right.
Yeah, I know. You were sort of very carefully sort of going, Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah.
Yes.
Well done. Yeah.
And onto a film that's half the length of that, which is The Great Escaper, starring Michael Caine.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. So directed by Oliver Parker, starring Michael Caine and Glenda Jackson. Based on a true story, D-Day veteran Bernie Jordan lives in a retirement home with his wife, Renee. The 70th anniversary of the Normandy landings is fast approaching. Annoyingly, Bernie leaves it too late to register for the official tour party. Undeterred, he decides to make his own way over. Care staff smell a rat, but Renee playfully covers for their errant resident. Walking frame in hand, he boards across the border ferry, and is befriended by Arthur, an ex-RAF pilot. They discover common ground as demons from the war continue to haunt them. Bernie and Arthur are introduced to German veterans with whom they share memories of D-Day. The realization soon dawns that language is all that separates them. The grand ceremony is about to begin, and Arthur has secured front row seats. However, Bernie's pilgrimage is not yet complete. This is a beautiful film. It's a wonderful film. Caine and Jackson are outstanding in their respective roles and make a convincing couple in their sunset years. There's real truth in the portrayal of two people who've lived a happy and fulfilling life. But like so many of their generation, are trapped by memories of a lost youth. Vivid flashbacks to the war are brilliantly captured with super sharp editing. William Ivory's excellent script crackles with pathos and gentle humour. What remains is a thoughtful account of how the elderly can be marginalised when they should be embraced for their knowledge and wisdom. It's a film we should all cherish and admire. I gave this film 5 stars, Chris. Just to put that rating in some context, I've written nearly 200 film reviews now, and I've awarded 5 stars on only 7 occasions. So that's about 3%. That's how highly I rate this film.
That is incredible. I mean, what, just to put it into immediate perspective, what would you give the Scorsese film?
I'd give it 4. I would have given it 4.
So there you go. I mean, that is... Because I've watched the trailer for this one, and I thought, oh, this looks like up my street. I like these sort of films. But to hear... I've known you given it 5 stars. It made me think, this is a must-see. And it doesn't feel like a must-see. When you kind of look at it on from the outside, you kind of think, oh, okay, it's a... You know, twee kind of thing coming along, but actually for it to be a must see, I love it.
Yeah, it's very understated. The publicity that drove the release of the film wasn't quite as well. It's never going to be anything approaching Oppenheimer or Killers of the Flower Moon or Mission Impossible. It's not that kind of film, but it deserves the same kind of attention because you gain so much from it, and it's so sensitive. They're taking so much care over what the subject they're dealing with, because it's not just dealing with the war. It's dealing with the way we see the elderly, the way they can be neglected and overlooked. You know, it was almost sad watching Michael Caine and Glenda Jackson on screen. They were well into their 80s when the film was made. They looked so frail and vulnerable. But that's the curse of actors who've had long careers. You see them aging on screen. And of course, Glenda Jackson died shortly after the film was finished. But there's something beautiful about it, the way it's written, the way it's acted. Very sensitively done, but it is a fantastic film and one of the films of the year for me.
Wow.
It's great.
That is huge. Is Caine finished acting now?
There's a question, because... he said at one point, no, I've not finished acting yet. He was apparently working on a new film about Charles Darwin, but then later reports confirmed that he'd retired. I think the issue he's got is, at the age of 90, there are probably fewer roles that would suit him now. The Great Escaper is probably the last leading role he would get, even if he chose to carry on acting. But after 160 films, what is there left to do? Really, in that way. But I'd like him to carry on, but, you know, because I used to think there were no rules in acting, that you could carry on for as long as you want to. Well, maybe he just doesn't want to anymore. It must be difficult at that age to master a script, do all the promotional work. It must be grueling, even for someone half his age. But, you know, I think Michael Caine's one of the greatest actors ever. Anyway, so maybe I'm a bit biased when I talk about Michael Caine.
No, he is an absolute legend. And I think, you know, for this to be out in the cinemas, if you're listening to this right now, that people should go see it. Because like you say, it wasn't overly promoted. Not many people probably even knew about it. For it to have the title The Great Escaper is probably going to be confusing to some people anyway.
But, you know, I mean, it's basically a true story as well. And the title for the film actually came from a news report. I think a local reporter called it The Great Escaper. But in a way, it's a good title for the film because it gives some familiarity. It's a trigger for people, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, but it's a film about war, but it's not a war film necessarily. So, you know, I can't offer a greater recommendation. Then please go and see it, you know. It's still on. I mean, at the time of us recording this episode, it's still running.
And if you're in the future, hi again. It's always nice talking to people in the future.
Yeah.
Do check it out wherever you can find it, because it's probably available somewhere. Unless something terrible has happened, in which case, try and send us a message if you can. Let us know what happens.
Yeah.
Because I'm not watching the news anymore.
You've given up, haven't you?
I've given up.
It's wise. Sensible.
we're moving on from the cinema films now because we have got a lot of indies to get through. But before we get there, as it is the scariest month of the year, although I think January should be the scariest, to be honest.
January is the most expensive month of the year. That's when you've got to pay for Christmas, isn't it?
Got to pay for everything and you've got to face that horrible weather. But October is where we get our scary movies in. Mm. And for this month's streaming pick, we decided to go with a fairly... probably unknown horror film, which landed on Netflix, can you guess what date? Friday the 13th of October.
Could it be any other time, though? Really?
Well, you had to, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's a Swedish horror film from Patrick Eklund called Conferensen, which is the Swedish name, but it's called The Conference if you're looking for it on Netflix. They've gone with the English title there. You've seen this, Brian?
I've seen it, yes.
Yes. Now, I often get to pick these films. I'm the one that chooses them. And I was quite happy to find something that was bordering in the horror comedy genre.
It is quite funny in places.
It is funny. Yeah. And I think, to give the setup, first off, you've got this company of people who are going on a team building conference in these sort of cabins in the woods. And it becomes quite clear that their plans to open this shopping mall in the area are surrounded by drama and some, obviously, negativity from some people and positivity from others. There's also a few rifts within the group because it looks as if there's some corruption going on and X, Y, Z. But once they get to the cabin, they start doing some of the team building activities, but all hell breaks loose because someone has turned up and is going to start picking them off one by one. And this just leads slightly back into what I was saying earlier about filmmakers having to contrive reasons for why people don't have their phones. And this one worked quite well because at a team building thing, they are quite keen on, like, look, do you know what? You can't have your phone because we're all here to connect.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. But you know, that's good. I like films that kind of fill in the obvious gaps, credibility gaps, if you like. And they do that here. You know, and I think that's really important because I don't think as a movie audience, we shouldn't have to suspend our disbelief all the time. We should be able to say, well, that wouldn't have happened. But you see, what I think is good about this film, Chris, is that it's something that we kind of understand. People on a team building exercise or on a away day, or whatever you want to call it, we've all been on those sort of days, haven't we? Mm. When we're with people we don't necessarily want to be with, doing things we don't really feel like doing, but know where we have to. It's a corporate thing. And I like that kind of approach because it assumes that there'll be some understanding from the audience that they know what this setup is like. But of course, what comes next is something totally different. But I think it was great. I really enjoyed it. You know, I'm not a huge fan of horror, but this one I think was bang on the money. I think it was really good.
That, I think, for me, the crucial element with horror is, first off, is it believable? Because quite a lot of the time this just isn't. And secondly, is it taking itself too seriously? Because that, I think, sometimes if it's not fun, like there's a lot of horror films where they are just going for the gore.
Yeah, I know,
like,
that's right.
You're like, it's fine, but no one's enjoying themselves here. Like, fair enough, you come up with all this horrible violence, but who's going to come away and want to watch that again? Whereas with the conference, the setup was believable. I totally understood why they were there, because often that's a problem. Like, why would you shut yourself off from the world? But with this, it's like kind of part of the point is that you need to be. And then, like I say, they take their phones away because they don't want people chatting, and then that box of phones gets taken. And also, the kills in this are very creative. They're really, really even at times I was wincing, but I was also laughing at the same time. One involving a hot tub, which I won't spoil, but that I was like, oh my god. It was really, really clever. Lots of great ways of making it feel threatening. There's lots of peril. You do genuinely sort of care. Oh, because it's also, you've got a completely mixed bag of characters. Yeah. It's not like, you know, oh, it's all the teens at the cabin in the woods. Yeah. It's like, no, there's like people of all ages. They're all part of this group, and some are kind of quite cynical, and some are like, yeah, these, like, money hungry yuppies kind of people. And yeah, you've got lots going on. There's lots of things to root for. Yeah. There's lots of things to sort of condemn. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah. Strong characters, a strong storyline as well. I like the narrative, because with horror movies, they often don't, they're not overly concerned with the plot, are they, really? But it's a strong narrative. You know, there's that kind of environmental dimension, because they're building this shopping mall, aren't they? And they're ploughing through the local environment. Property rights are being affected. So, you know, they're making enemies by what they're doing. It's a corporate thing, but they're making enemies because of their work, because of what they're doing. So they become vulnerable, being where they are, because there is this person who's seeking revenge. And there's a very good backstory there that gradually unfolds. Oh, I'd say what I also like about it is that they make you wait. You know, it's like half an hour before anything really happens, but you're getting to know the characters a little bit. But they don't sort of, you know what's coming, you know what to expect, but they make you wait for a little while. They build up the tension. You know, there's a scene very early in the film where the chef goes off on a drive in the woods, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he gets out of his car. Straight away you think, oh, this is where it's going to start, but it doesn't. Then it switches back to the main sort of storyline, back to the camp. And I like that, because it's not kind of being too obvious, and it's keeping you on your toes as a viewer, you know. And yeah, there's some nice comedic touches there as well. I liked it when the manager of the camp said to the caretaker, go and fix the Wi-Fi. And he goes off and he pulls the Wi-Fi out of the plug out of the router and plugs it back in again. Yeah, that's fixed the Wi-Fi, yeah. But, you know, there's lots of nice touches like that. But I could honestly see this becoming, for horror fans, it will appear in horror fans' top 10 movies. I think it is that good. I really do. It's good stuff. Oh.
There you go. And like I said, I think even though it came out on Friday the 13th, I struggled to see it on my Netflix. So I had to look for it specifically. So if you have, if you can't see it, The Conference, it's worth checking out. And yep, I think it is a Netflix like original, or like they're certainly the people behind it. So it should be on there for quite a while.
It's a co-production, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you're listening to this in 2029, then hopefully it's still on there. Yeah. And if so, I hope I'm still around. That'd be great.
Let's be positive.
Yeah, let me know. Just send me a message. Just say, Chris, you're still around. If I'm not, then maybe leave it. So that was The Conference, and that was our streaming pick of the month. Hope you enjoyed that. Now, we're moving on to our indies, and we have got a record-breaking 6 to review. Is that right?
Six to review.
And we're going to start with a documentary from Alex Perry called Angle.
Since I was a young kid, I always wanted to do something great.
He was one of the best conditioned athletes in the world.
Kurt Angle went and trained at Foxcatcher.
He was determined to be Olympic champion.
It was the proudest moment of my life.
What am I going to do now?
Oh, it's true! It's damn true!
He had great chemistry with anybody he stepped foot in the ring with. That's how good he was.
The irony of the success and the bright light, this can be very alluring. But then there's a dark side.
4 breaks in 2.5 years. I just wanted to keep going until I couldn't go any longer.
This Olympic gold medalist, I mean, you think he's bulletproof, but nobody is.
I was so out of control.
It makes my story look very lame.
And now this is about the wrestler, Kurt Angle. Did you know Kurt Angle before you came to this documentary?
No, I've never heard of him.
So this will be interesting, because I was a massive wrestling fan at the time of when he was popular.
Really?
Sort of just before, really. When the Rock and The Undertaker and people like that. He came kind of slightly after it. But he was in the thick of it when I was watching wrestling. So I did know. Right. And when I saw the review go up, I was like, oh, Angle, what's that then? Yeah. And I looked and I thought, that's Kurt Angle. And I thought, oh, hold on. We've got a documentary about someone that I genuinely know. Because he... was, and you know, going into the territory of the film, he was actually an Olympic wrestler to begin with, and then he went into the main kind of WWE stuff. And that was his whole thing, was about being this Olympic wrestler. So when I heard this documentary, I was like, actually, I bet that's a fascinating story. So I'll kick off, because obviously you didn't know who he was, Brian.
No.
Right? You know,
no. I'm a sports fan, right? But be honest, I only watch wrestling when it's in the Olympics, but I still hadn't heard of him, even though he was an Olympic gold medalist. So, you know.
Yeah, back in the, I think it was the 90s, wasn't it? So Kurt Angle, in the documentary follows him pretty much through his whole life up to now. We find out about his home life, one of three brothers, I think, and he had a sister. He talks about his father being an alcoholic, but who would hide it quite well and who would sort of not drink with the kids. He dies, his father dies in a tragic accident at work. And then during all this time, he's also training to be a wrestler, an Olympic wrestler. He's very good at sports, all the brothers are, but he shows a particular sort of penchant for wrestling and ends up going very far with it. As we've mentioned, he becomes the Olympic champion, not after, you know, a small amount of amazing work. He goes through loads of stuff, injuries, lots of things that he breaks
problems.
He breaks his neck and he ends up still wrestling numerous times. And
honestly, Chris, I couldn't believe how many times he broke his neck and carried on wrestling.
I thought a broken neck was a one-time thing. I thought that was, okay, well, you're dead, aren't you? But no, not for Kurt Angle. He just keeps wrestling.
I found this absolutely fascinating. You know, but I probably enjoyed the first part of the film more than the second part, because the first part of the film was building up to the Olympics and, you know, the trials and tribulations he had, and he lost a very close friend, didn't he? And his father died. But in the Olympic trials, he fell awkwardly on his neck. And this wasn't WWE. This is really strict amateur wrestling, where they adhere to sort of very strict rules, don't they? And he landed on his neck and broke four vertebrae, which were pressing into his spinal cord. Now, one more heavy blow to the neck could have killed him, could have paralyzed him. And he admitted that in the film, didn't he? That he said one more hit, it could have been the end. That, to me, just shows that elite athletes are a different animal to the rest of us. They think in a completely different way. This is a competitive edge coming out. And that's beyond my comprehension. I don't know about you. I mean, just to understand what drives somebody like that.
I think that was quite a powerful part of the film, is because often when you see biopics about sports people, they're sometimes not involved, like they're not actually even in the film. But Kurt Angle is very much in this, like he's narrating a lot of it, so you are getting it directly from him in terms of what he did and what happened. And like talking about one of the training things was he would put someone on his back and run up a hill numerous times. I thought listening to you say that makes me tired. I've sat there lying on the sofa sipping a Diet Coke, and I'm thinking, this guy's carrying people up hills.
I know. It's just unreal. Like I say, true athletes have to be competitive and have to be so single-minded that they ignore the obvious risks to achieve the ultimate goal, whatever it is. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what was driving him when he went into WWE, because that's entertainment, isn't it? That's showbiz. You know, what drives an athlete to win an Olympic gold medal is different to what drives you when you're in a completely different field. You know, I mean, WWE is great fun, great entertainment, but it's not sport. It's not competitive sport in the same way as it was in the Olympics. So there's a difference there.
I think that's part of the big story there, though, is that he dedicates the first part of his life so much to this winning the gold. Like, he was so driven that when he achieved it, he just didn't know what to do. It was like, well, where do I go from here? Like,
I know.
And one of the family members says, like, you know, it's not really worth anything. You know, you've got a gold medal in your hand, but you know, she says you've got something else in your other hand. I'll leave it up to the listeners to decide what that is. But she was, it's very true. He's like, well, it doesn't, it's not like, oh, okay, well, now you've got, you know, £1 million a year for life. They don't give you a salary from that. Like, you, and I think the whole training side of it, and it was kind of, it felt like, you know, Full Metal Jacket. It felt like, oh, it's like the training session, you know, in that first part of the film was really grueling. And then it goes into this other start of the story, which you're like, oh, okay, well, now it's this, which is totally different to what we've just seen. Also, they go to Foxcatcher. Have you seen Foxcatcher, the film?
No, I haven't, actually.
I strongly recommend that film. Steve Carell. And you hear about it in this because Kurt Angle was one of the actual athletes that went there. But the film, because when they said Foxcatcher, I thought, is that, that's the same place? It must be. And yeah, the film, obviously, because we find out, I won't go into that because actually you should, obviously you already know kind of what happens, I guess, because you've seen this. But yeah, fabulous film. And also gives you an idea about what we're talking about when we're talking about these athletes going to such levels of you know, training regime, exhaust training, really, like they're trying to basically just outlast their opponent. They go, well, if I never get tired, then I'll win because eventually the other one's just going to give up.
What I think actually comes through here, though, is that is the determination, dedication to be the best at something. But then, as you just mentioned, that kind of deflation once you have got there. It's the old analogy about astronauts that go to the moon. Or somebody that climbs Mount Everest, how do you top it? You've got to the top. What do you do then? Do you just stay there? Do you just hold? Or what do? Where do you go after that? And I suppose really to have a gold medal in Olympic wrestling doesn't have the same kudos as a gold medal in track and field would have, for example. So it doesn't kind of... You can't build on that necessarily, and that's what led him into WWE. But I really like Kurt Angle. You know, he interviews well. He's very down to earth, honest, very candid about his life, and that's what makes it even more riveting. And really, I think this film helps to promote wrestling as a sport because, frankly, I'd never heard of Kurt Angle.
Yeah, it's funny because I like I said, I was very much into it for a phase you know, when I was a kid, and he was in that phase, and I think seeing it again was really nostalgic for me. I was like, oh, this is just like, some of the interviewees, like Dwayne Johnson is on there, and Steve Austin, who played who's Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
yeah, with his beer cans. I'm going to start doing that at the beginning of shows. I'm just smack my beer cans together.
Why not?
but yeah, I thought that, you know, that was really powerful to have them in. It gave a bigger edge because this could have just been like a home movies type sort of thing. But when you also get through to the part of the film where he's dealing with spoilers, if you don't want to know this, but he is dealing with painkiller addiction. That their input on that in terms of what they're saying to him, how they're helping him through it, that was really powerful to me. And I really enjoyed that part. I felt, because like you say, Angle's great at interviews and he does give you some quite good emotion when he's talking about these things and what he was doing and how many he was taking. And it was just really...
And he wasn't over emotional, was he? I mean, when he was genuinely moved, when he was recounting something that happened in his life, he wasn't bursting into tears every 5 minutes, was he?
No.
Now and again, but you could see when he was showing real emotion. What makes this a very good... I mean, I like documentary films. I think they're great, and I think they're often underrated within that kind of genre of films generally. And they do rank alongside action movies and historical epics, whatever, right? Documentary films have their place, and this is particularly good. I put this at the top end of really good documentary films because it tells the story of the rise, fall, and recovery of someone. And you don't always get that kind of positive end. You know, these sorts of documentary films are often leave you on a downer. This one doesn't.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we both agreed, very powerful documentary.
Absolutely.
I got a small criticism, which I don't really need to mention, but the only thing I would say is just, I think the music and the score was being quite melodramatic at times. Like, it felt a bit too, ooh, up and down, like trying to like take you on this journey, which I don't think it needed to do. I felt like the content was good enough. Like, it was really compelling. They didn't need to kind of create this artificial environment for it to feel like, oh, this is where you should be sad, and this is where you should feel that it's tense. Like, we kind of knew it was tense. Like,
Yeah, you're right. I think it's almost like a prompt, isn't it, with the scoring, the soundtrack. Some films don't need it. I don't think the film needed music at all. You know, some films do, but I think you really need to think about whether it's going to enhance the film. And a documentary doesn't really need that, because you've got the drama there already because of the story that we're hearing. So, yeah.
There you go. So the documentary is called Angle, and you can read the review. I think Jason reviewed it on the website, so do go and check it out, because you know, see what he made of it, and obviously see whether you align with what we've said. In terms of the film itself, I'm just going to see if I can see anything in terms of what they said about release. Not that I could see. So, yeah, and I think, yeah, we had a password protected link. There's no information currently other than an IMDb page from what I can see. So, yeah, one of those ones where you probably have to check back. But, you know, I'm sure if you're following any of, like maybe even Kurt Angle himself, if not Alex Perry, the filmmaker, or just drop us a line if you're interested in seeing it. We can always try and coax some more information out of the filmmakers to get that to you. Okay, moving on to a short film now called Gus Should Get the Girl. This was, again, reviewed by Jason on the website. Written and directed by Joseph Raich, and stars Marcel Raich, who I'm guessing related. I think that's
safe bet, isn't it?
Really? Safe bet. I put money
safe
on that.
Safe bet. Yeah. Along well, you would give your relative a part in a film if he was making it, wouldn't you?
I wouldn't. My brother knows that. You know, I wouldn't put him in a film. No. He's done too many horrible things to me in the past.
Oh,
you know?
Okay, fair enough.
He really teased me as a kid. I was like wrestling, you know, putting me in headlocks and stuff. So the film stars Marcel Raich, Kayla Kelly, and Joey Lundholm, and essentially is about a young lad, sort of teenager, sitting in a diner, and he is prepping for a big date. He has a date with a girl later on, and he plans to meet his friend Tim to talk about, you know, the strategies of, you know, wooing women.
We've all been there, haven't we? We've all been there.
Yeah. And it's his, you know, he's playing through what he's going to, like, how he's going to come across in the date. But instead of his friend turning up, his friend's mum turns up, and our protagonist sees this as an opportunity to just test some of his methods and strategies to see whether they how they go down on his friends. What do you think of this one, Ryan?
I really enjoyed it. I think it was really good fun. It's sweet, endearing, funny, and a fair reflection of the angst we all go through in adolescence. You know, wanting to be cool and grown up, impressing a girl, but the awkwardness and fear of failure, it's all in there. And I like the setup whereby he's got the cue cards, hasn't he? Rehearsing his lines, and then this mature, attractive woman turns up, not instead, but before it all kind of starts, and that's Tim's mum. I thought, right, I'll try it out. And I love that. I love the simplicity of it and the fact that it is relatable, because we've all been through that, and it reminds you how awkward and painful it was when we all went through it, you know, and it's life is a learning process, but really good fun, really enjoyable, nice and light, and speaks a lot of truth. And, you know, films that work the best are the ones that we can see something of ourselves in.
Yeah, I thought it was one of those films that, on one hand, it kind of felt like maybe it was a project, you know, like a school film project, that thing. We're gonna make a thing in the local diner, and, you know, kind of, it felt fairly basic in terms of the setup. But then when I started to unpick my feelings on the film, I was like, actually, this is quite a rich film here. There's actually quite a lot going on here. It plays on a lot of classic themes and coming of age feelings and storylines. And you've got, I think, quite a good central performance, in particular the mum. I think the mum, when she comes, lends quite a good amount of credence to the performances. And I think she also coaxes quite a good one out of our lead, Marcel. I think that you needed that with a film like this, because had it been just, you know, young characters, I don't know if the caliber of the acting would have been there. But as it is, it actually works quite well. Yeah. Some of the camera work is a bit jolting. That's one of my notes I've got. I was kind of feeling that it was a bit all over the place when it didn't really need to be.
This feels, I mean, we're talking earlier about what we understood by the term indie film. This feels more like a traditional indie film, really. It doesn't have that kind of poise and polish, but, you know, doesn't mean to say that it's any less effective, but you can see that they've got a more limited budget compared to some of the other films that we've reviewed here tonight, but it still works. But, you know, as I say,
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So it kind of feels more like a traditional indie film, what you would expect to see in an indie film. You know, but I think you're right about the mother, though. She's a pivotal character in that story, right? Because straight away, he's kind of upping his game, not just in the acting stakes, but the character is kind of going up a notch, where this hot date is around the same age as him. That there you've got a grown-up, adult, mature woman who's kind of teaching him in her own way, you know. So I like that too. It's a nice sort of spin on a story that we've seen many times before, but it's a question of how you execute it, isn't it? You know.
It's available actually to watch. If people can watch Gush Should Get the Girl on YouTube, just search for it. I'm sure it'll come up. And obviously, again, go to the website to read Jason's review, because he was very positive about it too. There's a trailer there, you know, if you want to watch the trailer just to see, get a feel for the film. Because, like we said, you know, indie films often now are coming out with such a good quality. It'd be good to hear what people think of this one, because we are able to sort of show it, people are able to see it. So that's Gush Should Get the Girl. Moving on to an indie feature now from Ben Echels. This is again, comedy horror. We've got another comedy horror here. It's what it's labelled as anyway on IMDb.
You don't sound convinced there.
Well, when I remember this film, I don't remember it. I suppose it is, yeah. It Being Evil Moon is the film.
Shut it, you drunken old goat. Only Mary, your shenanigans and you'll get nothing. And you'll be mocking your own porridge tomorrow.
Silent as a moose. Silent as a moose.
It'd be an evil moon. The stars flickered and the mountain slept silently. An old sheepdog sat in a rock watching his flock. Not once had he lost a sheep. Even when he slept, he could listen for any possible danger. One of the sheep approaches him and asks him, "So why do you guard us every night?" And the old dog said, "Because it's my job." The sheep ponders, then asks another question. So what is our job then? The dog says. Your job? Your job is to give birth every year so your babies can be eaten.
Bloody hell. Is that it?
Aye.
Bit morbid like. Your granny told you this?
Aye, when I was a wee bairn.
Fuck me, Mildred. I'm going for a slash.
Do you want to do the setup? What's the film?
Yeah, okay then. So, yeah, directed by Ben Edgell, starring Richard Allen, Ian Ray White, Rod Glenn, and Gordon Joseph Miller. So, yeah, so we're in keeping with the theme of this episode. Freddie is a former scientist who now ekes out a living as a minicab driver and also supplies the local gangster with drugs. But he has a side hustle. Freddie's developing a formula to cure hair loss. Being follically challenged himself, he dreams of the day when he finally cracks the case. He has an elderly mother who is bedbound but prone to the occasional wander. He tries the new formula on his own pate. Awaking the next morning, he is her sweet, with a full beard. His joy knows no bounds, but what forces has he unleashed? That's the question, isn't it? I think the film generally works very well. It's an interesting new take on the genre. All I would say about it is that the story seems to tail off a little bit towards the end and doesn't really offer the viewer a satisfactory conclusion. I was kind of expecting a bit more. Now, people listening might watch it and think, oh, no, it's fine. But I was wanting a bit more, but the setup's great. And I like the angle with the drug dealer as well, because there's all kinds of directions this storyline could have gone in. So it surprises you in that way. But no, I thought it was pretty decent.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of the plotting. I found it similar. I thought it didn't go satisfactory by the end for me. Mm. I'd enjoyed the bulk of it. I thought it was a really good mix, because obviously stories about werewolves and things like that have been done in the past. And
yeah,
you're entering into quite a hallowed genre, really. To do a film like this, you know, it needs to be worthy, it needs to have a good story. And I liked it. I liked the setup. And the latter part of the film, funny enough, was actually where I thought it was really getting into gear. I was like, oh, here we go. Like, you know, and this is where, especially with the landscape, the beautiful landscape that they were in.
I know.
Gets to that cabin. Yeah. Did you recognize the guy in the cabin?
He looked familiar.
Yeah, Gordon Joseph Miller. He was in a film that we reviewed at last year's festival.
Right.
It was the film set in a pub where he played Baroness was what it was called.
I know. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, we couldn't work out what it was called. Baroness. That was it, wasn't it? It's that one.
Funny enough, he turned up to the event that I did where I got all the filmmakers there. Right. And it was great to see him in this. I thought his scene with his partner was probably the best. It was such a great part. That's the clip that we'll play. It's actually him with her talking about the story of it being an evil moon. And I thought that was where the film should have been more focused on, whereas actually we got a lot to begin with, and it took a long time to get to the bits that were actually a bit more kind of exciting, I guess.
I think you're right. Those conversations towards the end were very cleverly put together, and this is where I think we're agreed on this, that it kind of tailed off a little bit, that it didn't reach that proper conclusion because it was setting something up which it appeared to not necessarily do. But it was good. There was a lot to enjoy there. A lot to enjoy and a lot to take in. But it's all good.
And I think like the film, like we're going back to the genre, is like comedy horror. There is this sort of mix of sinister and silly, which does work quite well. The funniest bit for me was this bloke that sits out the back of his house in a deck chair, and he just throws a beer can every time he sees him. He just throws a beer can.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, that is just hilarious. Like, why?
Yeah, that is good. Yeah.
Why is he there?
Yeah.
And also, there's a bit where someone gets attacked with CGI seagulls.
Yeah,
that was just that was really funny. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's got this sort of zany, fun element to it, and it's got like this sort of interesting premise with the horror story. I think where the film slightly lets itself down is it doesn't lean more into that story and give us a bit more, because it is actually, I don't think it was that long from what I remember.
Hour 21 minutes, I think.
So it could have maybe given us a little bit more. But
yeah.
That being said, you know, it's a really worthy, interesting film people should seek out. Let me just see if we've got any information about a release. There is a Facebook, well, it says people, but if you search Facebook for It Be an Evil Moon, or Twitter, at It Be an Evil Moon. On Instagram, it's Medusa Media Productions. So there's information out there. There's trailers and things. The film viewing link was a YouTube link, but I don't know if it was public or not. Let me check that as well. I don't think it is. Yeah, so it might not be out just yet, but I've given you some links there in terms of where you can find out more, because these films are really hard. You know, to make a feature film is difficult, and to make one that is doing so much as what this is, that you know, hats off to the filmmakers, because I think they've done a fabulous job. We just wanted more of it, I think.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, all the ingredients are there. It was a great effort. But, you know, like I say, it's all about what you get from it yourself. You know, I think we more or less drew the same conclusions, the two of us, didn't we, about the film itself. But, you know, someone else could look at it and think, oh, no, you know. But that's the beauty of filmmaking and watching films like this, is that we all get something slightly different from it. But this is a fine effort, and it's all there, but it's a question of how you present it and where you go with it. It's got great potential. It's a word I often come back to with films like this, because you think, it's all there, it's all in place, but you just got to shape it and develop it. But it's good, though. Good stuff.
There we go. It Be an Evil Moon. Next up, we're heading to a short film written and directed by Brandon Haynes. It's a film called Two Truths and a Lie. And Chris Buick reviewed this on the website and gave it, I think, 5 stars. And I was like, ooh.
Yeah, bold statement, eh?
That is a bold statement. And having seen the film, I can see why it's got 5 stars. I love the setup for this film. So essentially, it's about three people from different career backgrounds who all struggle to lie. And they are going through a counseling session with a slightly unorthodox counselor who is going to try and get them to be able to lie more comfortably, because it affects these people quite seriously. So one's like a professional poker player, so obviously needs to be able to lie and bluff. There's like a social media personality who, you know, can't sort of get by. I can't remember what the other person.
It's a lawyer, isn't it? Is it a lawyer? It's a lawyer, I think.
Might be. Which, if it was, then that's playing on the whole liar film, we've seen before. I think you're right, actually. So the film works really well, even just with those three personalities. But I actually agree with Chris's review, which he says that this show stealer really is the therapist. She is absolutely balmy. She does things to sort of elicit these responses from them to try and get them to lie, and it is hilarious. Really funny, but also a little bit disturbing. Like, it feels a little bit like on the sort of thriller side at the same time. Did you get that feeling?
Of course. I think it's kind of it's a mix of all kinds of sort of styles and approaches that it does have elements of thriller / chiller / comedy. It's got all those elements mixed in. I think it's good. It's very good. It's such a great premise. Again, we talk about the premise, don't we? The setup. What's the basic plot? How does it work? And this is brilliant. I love the idea of a support group for those who can't help but tell the truth. And the first thing I thought was, this is far too big an idea for a short film. You know, we often talk about the potential that short films have to be something more than a short film. And this could work as a feature film or even a TV series. You know, they've got a lawyer, poker player, an influencer. you know, just think of the clients that Melissa could get. Just imagine people in professions where the need to tell the truth might cause a bit of a problem for them, and that needs curing. So it's got dynamic potential, and you think, you give this to a top comedy writer or a top thriller writer, this is gold. This is pure gold. And I completely endorse Chris Buick giving it 5 stars, because in context, to do what they've done in the space of, what, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it was, that is hell of an effort. Really impressed with it.
I think so too. Yeah. And like you said, I agree. I think, you know, web series or a film or a show, because there's so much. I did feel this was one, much like the previous film, it finished and I was like, no. Yeah, there should be more here. More here, please.
Yeah.
And I think they only gave you a few different things which she does in terms of like the methods to get to life. And I was like, oh, there could be so more. There could have been so many more things to really bring this out. Obviously, maybe that's the sign of a good film, is wanting you to sort of, you know, you leave you wanting more. So I can't always be too sort of hard on them for that. But as a proof of concept, there's something big here that, you know, could certainly be.
Well, Chris, I'll be very surprised if this doesn't go somewhere. You know, that yes, it's a short film. They're working within a limited time frame. You know, they've got their, you know, the pace, the sequencing, the logical sequence of storytelling that they have to get into a limited time frame. They've got all that worked out. But I would be amazed if this didn't go somewhere else. I can't believe that you wouldn't do something more with it, with a short film like this. But we shall see. You never know. We might be reviewing a feature-length version in a year or two, I hope, you know, because it's an intriguing prospect. And you give it, I mean, it looked to me like it had a pretty decent budget anyway, but you give it a proper budget. Give it to Netflix. Give it to,
Really see that, because it had a kind of almost Black Mirror sort of feel to it. Like not in terms of total vibe, but in terms of the look and feel of it. I was like, I could see this working brilliantly as a binge-worthy series that someone would watch.
Absolutely.
Obviously, if it does get that far, Brandon, you do owe us some money, because we've bigged it up to that point.
What more could they ask for? We can't say fairer than that, can we, really?
We don't want a lot of the pie, just some of the pie.
Yeah, I know. We're not greedy, are we, Chris, really? No.
But if you want to find out more about Two Truths and a Lie, they are on socials. So they are using the number 2, so Two Truths, a Lie, all one word, on Instagram and Twitter. And it's also, they have a website for the main company called GorillaWolf.com. So no reason why you can't find more on that. I don't think it is out, because we got a password protected link for that one. But Two Truths and a Lie, 5 stars, definitely go see it if you can. I think it's fabulous. We are sticking with the short films. Going now to Elena Viklova's short film Intern, which Joe Beck gave 4 stars on the website. And I think, it's 4 or 5 for me. I thought this was fantastic. Really enjoyed it. So the setup is Isaac J plays a intern at this, well, basically in the basement, I think. And there's a group of people there all trying to vie for a position at a company. And the internship is about to come to an end for our main character's career. So he's trying his best to get in front of the CEO and to show him this report that he's made to try and, you know, get his job. You know, that's it. He's putting out all the stops. Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't go very well for him. He, through calamity and also through people that work there sort of keeping him down, he even gets stuck in a lift at one point. It doesn't really go too well. Then it does sort of change slightly towards the end. I thought, not only was this a really interesting story, and there's lots of great themes about capitalism and greed and how we perceive employment, but also it just looked great. It had this strange, like, hue to it, like a greeny kind of hue that made it feel like you're watching something from, like, the 70s, but felt very modern at the same time.
Yeah.
What did you think of Intern, Brian?
Yeah, I really liked it. I think it's very clever. It's very clever, very intelligent, perceptive filmmaking. again, within a very limited time frame. This is what I find very impressive about the ability to make a short film, is that you give it an end-to-end feel and you get a lot of detail there. A bit like Gus Should Get the Girl, it's very relatable. It starts off with a concept that we can all understand, right? You know, there's all, we've all been for a job that we really want, right? We're all competing to be accepted, to prove that we're worthy of someone's attention in the work environment. And I think the character's called Seth, isn't he? The main character. I think it's Seth, isn't it? The fact that he's trying to pull out the stops and do everything possible to get this job, to nail it, but still being asked to jump through numerous hurdles, you know, trying to overcome various obstacles. And that is something we can all understand, we can all relate to. But yeah, you're right. It's got visually, it's good. The script's good, and it works because it's something that we all get. We all get what the psyche of that character is, that he's determined to make all the right noises and get that job. And we can all understand that, can't we?
Yeah, and I think they matched it with this sort of, like, his energy, like his passion for trying to do this. The filmmaking kind of has that as well. Like, it feels like it's keeping up with him, and it feels at times like kind of quirky or frantic, or yeah, you know, it's keeping the viewer on their toes quite well, I found. And I think, like you say, people can relate to this. They can see that maybe in themselves, or you know, maybe they've done that at times, or even felt that way about something.
Yeah.
The central performance is really great. I think he does fabulously with the role. Mm. I like the supporting characters. There's one guy where he pulls his newspaper down and he just looks totally annoyed that he's been interrupted. I thought, yeah, that's just great.
Yeah,
and there's always someone at work that's like that, right? There's always that cynical guy that doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
And I think they capture that really well. They capture this element, even though it is kind of a bit of a oddball, strange premise, that actually there's a lot of familiarity there as well. There's lots of things that you're going to go, oh yeah, that feels relatable.
Well, also, Chris, that, you know, you can make a point by exaggerating, you know, and you can do that. You can sort of create a situation that looks extreme or far-fetched, but you're making a valid point at the same time. So you can make a point by exaggerating, and that's, in some ways, that's what they've done here. It's to take something to an extreme, but still enable the audience to understand what they're getting at. Which is, again, it's very clever. The word I keep on coming back to with the intern is clever, smart. It's smart filmmaking.
There we go. I mean, I can't say fairer than that. Intern short film is not out, as far as I'm aware. I might be wrong on that, but you can find them on Instagram. So @internfilm, all one word, and the review as well. Do go check out Chris Burek's very glowing review. I think it really does delve into the film and what he liked about it. Let us know if you are able to ever see it. Let us know what you think. It's always nice to hear from our listeners. Now, this next short film was one I reviewed on the website.
I know, so I see.
And another 5-star film.
It's well deserved. Very well deserved.
It's called The One Note Man.
Once upon a Christmas time, there was a musical man who lived a careful life. Each day was much like the next. And that was just how he liked it.
I feel like because I reviewed it, I'm going to let you do the synopsis on this. Okay. I might gush too much.
You might gush too much.
Yeah.
Should I be a bit harder on it? No, I can't really. I thought I might give a bit of a contrast, but I don't think I can really. Well, okay then. So directed by George Tsougas.
Tsougas.
starring Jason Watkins. It's a simple but lovable tale about a musician who plays the oboe in an orchestra. And his only contribution to the piece is one solitary note. The musician leads a humdrum existence, but is secretly in love with a lady that plays the violin in the same orchestra. Crippled by shyness, he tries in his own way to impress her. He stealthily builds up his part, much to the annoyance of the conductor. But will the pretty violinist respond to his delicate advances? I absolutely love this. I think it's fantastic. As you pointed out in your review, Chris, there are shades of Groundhog Day here. It's packed with symbolism. Isn't it really a grey life represented by this one note and an obsession with minutiae, you know, with loose strands on his jacket and a toothbrush always pointing upwards? I guess the moral here is that love will eventually set him free. It benefits hugely from Jason Watkins in the title role. Very familiar actor. We've seen him on film and TV. And he makes a lot of short films, doesn't he? You know, I think we reviewed a short film of his last year.
Yeah, I remember seeing him in a few things.
Yeah. And that's a big plus. Some good cameos there. Paul Barber, Trigger from Only Fools and Horses, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's, again, another strength. But the biggest strength of this film, in my opinion, Chris, in my humble opinion, is that there is no script. You know, I love words. I love words. I'm fascinated by the power of words. But here, words aren't necessary. You don't need a script, right? That means that without any dialogue, there are no language barriers. It has universal appeal. You could play it to any audience in any country in the world, any culture, whoever you take it to, they will understand this film. They'll get it because there are no language barriers. No need for subtitles, no need for dubbing, nothing, right? But they see a very human story unfolding here. I think it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Wow. I'm glad I managed to get my review in before you came and made me look silly, Brian.
Well, I was only trying to enhance it, Chris, myself, you know.
How profound you've done in your review, and I looked like a little 5-year-old with my review. But I'm glad that we're on the same page with this one.
It's
always, when you love a film, you kind of think, oh, am I going to be on my own here? I would have absolutely fought my corner, but I'm glad that you are on the same
page. We're agreed on that, absolutely.
It is one of those films, like you say, it's universal. Anyone can enjoy this film. Watkins is amazing. He's so good in this film.
He's great. Great actor.
He's got that kind of like Mr. Bean kind of feel. Not in terms of like that silliness, but in terms of the physical performance. Really is sort of that slight embellishment and slight kind of exaggeration to just really bring the audience in. Because otherwise you could just be like, oh, why do I care? And there's all these little moments. There's so many moments. In my review, I picked out Crystal Yu, who plays the conductor. The
conductor, yeah.
Giving him the evil eye when he ends up causing a bit of a ruckus. It's those things. They're small things, but actually it made it feel quite British. It made it feel like this is our sense of humour. We really enjoy these sort of stories absolutely. And this filmmaking. I thought it was just excellent. The cast, I say, is great. I liked the way that it also does play with the audience quite a bit because there is a, first you're watching, okay, he's just going through his humdrum life and there's almost like a slapstick feel to him just going in and out of the same room. Yeah. Then there's almost like a sad kind of feeling to it of, actually his experience. Then you get this love story and the meet cute because like he hadn't really noticed this other violinist. And then it becomes a love story. So you're getting a lot in this really short space time. This wouldn't work as any longer. This is exactly as long as it needs to be. Because it's perfectly, in tune to pay on a pound there. It's perfectly in tune with what the audience is going to want and expect from a film like this. Yeah. And every part of it is needed. Every single bit was like, that is
just perfect.
Yeah,
there's no padding.
There's nothing in there that you kind of think, you could have cut that down a bit. Yeah. And for a film that doesn't rely on dialogue, that's huge. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's even that short. I can't remember how long it was. I'm thinking it's about 20 minutes.
Yeah, 20 minutes probably. 20 minutes,
something like that. it's not like it was like a 3 minute music video. You know, it was like, you know, that's a long film. For some short films, they fit a whole feature length in that time. But to do this without any dialogue, I think is really ambitious. To do it with this cast as well, like, you've got to be pretty confident about the film you're going to make if you've got no dialogue and you're hiring these people to be in it.
I reckon for an actor, that's a very difficult part to play. If you've got no scripts, the major tool that you have as an actor is a script, isn't it? Mm. All right, you get an outline with what is basically, you could call it a silent movie because there's no dialogue, but they get an outline, but that they don't get a script. So you've taken a vital tool away from an actor. So it becomes a much more difficult part to play. You know what I was thinking when I was watching it? You know, it's almost Charlie Chaplin-esque in its approach, isn't it?
That's
a strength, really. You know, you kind of realise how great Charlie Chaplin was, and that if Charlie Chaplin was around today, I'm sure he would totally approve. And, you know, to me, to me, that's the greatest compliment you could pay a film like this, because that's the benchmark, that's the standard of an approach to making a film. But absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Really is.
And just to also note, Ian McKellen does a bit of narration. That is one of the only bits of dialogue that you do get.
Yeah, right at the beginning. Beginning and the end, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, if there was anything you could add on, you know, it's kind of like, what ingredient you're going to stick on to just improve something that's already perfect? It's going to be the voice of Ian McKellen. You know, it's going to be like, okay, now it's done. Now it's finished. It doesn't, it's only going to make it better. Going to make it better. Amazing. Yeah, really, really good.
To get that caliber of actors involved, I mean, Jason Watkins, Ian McKellen, Sir Ian McKellen, and also, you know, Joanna Klein, who played the violinist, you know, very well known. Well, an actor who you would instantly recognise. And also Paul Barber plays the florist, doesn't he? You know, it's to get all those touches, nice touches, and get these people involved. It shows how good it is, how much it's rated when you get that calibre of actor involved. So that's another great, great plus.
So that was The One Note Man. Do go read my review. If you've got lovely things to say about my writing, send them to me. If you've got not so nice things to say, send them somewhere else. the film, if you want to find out more, they have a website called Cusp Films. So that's CUSPFILMS.co.uk. So that's their website. And they are on social media. So Twitter, it'll be at Cusp Films. Instagram, it's at Cusp_Films. So I'm pretty sure the film is not out yet. I'm pretty sure it is doing the festival run, because I follow them on socials and they are talking a lot about festivals at the moment. However, it's the kind of film I could see it being released.
Shouldn't it? Really?
And people will be able to watch it on something like Omelette or something like that. So that's The One Note Man. And that's the end of our indie films, leaving us only the nostalgia pick for this month. As we say, it's a horror month. So we are obviously going to head to Disney. You know, that's where we're going. Disney Plus.
Obviously. Where else?
I wanted something from Disney Plus because I felt that, you know, we'd done Netflix for the streaming pick. And let's head to Disney. I had never seen The Omen. Now, So I put it as the nostalgia pick because this is partly what the nostalgia pick is for, which is those films which you kind of should have seen, that you feel that, oh, maybe it gives you a reason to watch them. And I thought I'd seen The Omen referenced so many times, like in pop culture. Do you know what always comes to mind is Only Fools and Horses, because of like Damien and that I was like, this is it. This is a good reason to watch it. Absolutely. Had you seen it before?
I had, a long time ago, though. It came out in 1976. I never realised it was that old, actually. I thought it was a bit more recent. I may have been thinking of the two sequels that they made. But the original film came out in 1976. I would have seen it the first time, possibly 10 years after, because at that time, films would take 4 or 5 years to appear on the small screen. So it probably would have been the mid-80s when I first saw it. But I've not seen it for a very long time. So this, for me, it's a bit, you know, we always say, don't we, that if you've not seen a film for years, you can see it with a fresh pair of eyes. So, yeah, I have seen it, but I've seen it previously, but a very long time ago, though.
It's also quite good with this nostalgia pick because you get that chance to go, is it how I remember? And like, you go back and watch a film and go, oh, okay, yeah, actually, yeah, that is as good. Like we did Fight Club, and I'd seen it so many times when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I watched it again. I was like, yeah, no, it still holds up. Still great.
Of course.
With this, I hadn't seen it, but it has a lot of similarities to films of that era, films that I have seen, you know, 70s horrors and things like that. It is one of the films as well that it has a place in horror legacy in terms of like what it's done and things like that. So the story centers around Gregory Peck's character. He's an ambassador called Robert Thorne, who very early on in the film, they lose their child in the hospital. And in order to not cause his wife any distress or his partner any distress, someone offers him the chance of having another child that sadly lost their mother at childbirth. So kind of a, well, you know, take this one instead situation, as you do. And years go by and he sort of, his life kind of becomes, he becomes quite successful in his career. But the child starts to seem a bit odd, to be honest, a bit weird, bit sinister. And it all comes to a head when someone dies at the at a picnic. She, is that the first one? That's the first one where she goes out the window, right?
Yeah, it's the, it's the nanny, isn't it?
Yeah, the nanny. And from there, it only gets weirder. And also, the a priest or some religious character keeps trying to track Gregory Peck's character down and warns him of this, warns that actually this child presents more evil than he may be prepared for, and it all links into the church, so they must stop him. At first, obviously, he doesn't really believe him, but then more and more things start to happen, and chaos and violence ensue. It escalates into horror territory. what did you think watching this again, Brian? How did you feel like watching this 70s horror film in 2023?
I think it still works. It still definitely works. Alongside The Wicker Man, now we've mentioned The Wicker Man before, haven't we? But alongside The Wicker Man, this film is the benchmark for all horror movies. They get the basics right. You know, great director in Richard Donner, great cast, Gregory Peck, a genuine film legend, Lee Remick, Billy Whitelaw, David Warner, Patrick Troughton, who plays the priest. You know, they're all excellent actors, know what they're doing. So they've got all the basics right, you know, and a very strong story that's telling quite a kind of an explicit tale, really, you know, about the kind of the mirror image of Jesus, isn't it, really? You know, the son of the devil. And ties in with religion and religious symbolism. It is still shocking. It still feels shocking. It still works. You know, there are certain scenes in the film that still make me jump. And, you know, I don't often get affected in that way by a horror movie, but some films do it to me, and this is one of them. You know, one, you can pick out all kinds of scenes that will shock you and linger in the memory. But the where Lee Remick's character, the mother, is on the stairs trying to fix the light, and the kid comes along on it on his bike or on his tricycle. That is a genuinely shocking scene. It really is, and it does make you jump out of your seat for it momentarily.
It did remind me a lot of The Shining, because I was like, that felt very akin, right?
Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah, that's obviously where they got it from, though, wasn't it? That, you know, in some ways, all films are derivative, aren't they, of something else, of something you've seen previously, you know, and that's why I think the Omen is so influential, that they get they draw on lots of ideas that they put down in a film like the Omen. But it works, you know, it does what it's supposed to do, and it, even though it is what, 47 years old, you know, it still manages to be thought-provoking, disturbing, scary. With very few special effects, with pretty basic effects that, you know, they represent the 70s in some ways, where there was nothing. I don't know. You film The Omen today, right? You imagine what you could do with all the techniques and tricks and wizardry you've got at your disposal now. But I don't think they could make that film any better now than they did then. If you see what I'm getting at.
Oh, 100%. When it comes to horror, like, if you've got practical effects, they still work way better than CGI. And I think it's the kind of film where they're doing a lot of supernatural big stuff. Like, they've got the hellhounds, they've got the there's a storm at one point that kind of goes crazy, that it's like they had to do all that. Like, those were real dogs, you know, that was a real storm that they had to recreate, like, using effects. It's like that has to be applauded. You have to, and that's why it stands up, I think, because it's like, well, you did it, you made it. Whereas I think with anything CGI, even 5-10 years, you'll notice, because technology's changed and the way that they've done that is very different, but it's still in the same ballpark. But with this, it is just, you've made it happen. I did find I liked the film. I liked that there was a lot of heritage here in terms of horror filmmaking. I've so many bits where I was like, oh, they've referenced that in this film, they've referenced that in this film. So I like that. Obviously, this is kind of like an OG story.
Yeah,
I did feel that it was, on one hand, it was taking itself quite seriously, which I found hard, because, like I said, with me and horror, I think if everyone's taking it really seriously, I get a bit bored. If it doesn't feel that fun, I wouldn't say it was that fun of a film.
No, it's with, very serious, isn't it?
Yeah. With the conference earlier, this is perfectly up my street. You know, it's funny, it's fun, but it's also got some scares and it's a bit terrifying. With this, it was just trying to be scary, but also playing very heavily into the religious side of things, which I just found, okay, that's fine. That, and also some of the effects were a bit overbearing, like the music and the lighting. Like, you're watching it just going, okay, all right.
Calm it down.
But that is obviously, you know, you're talking about a film made decades ago, that it's the style has changed. And imagine seeing this in the cinema at the time. I bet it was like, oh my God, like, experience. Yeah. Whereas watching it on Disney Plus in 2023 is a bit like, okay, calm it down. But I do, I think a sign of a good film is if there is more films that you want to watch. And I finished this and thought, do you know what? I'm going to try and check out The Omen 2. Like, I feel like I want to know, because it's the same character, isn't it? Like,
yeah, it's the character developing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if you, sorry, Chris, go on.
I was just thinking we probably should have put a spoiler in there, but do we need to put spoilers for films that are over 40 years old?
I don't know. What do you reckon?
Nah. We'll get letters, but I just delete them.
Delete the letters,
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
By which I mean burn them.
That kind of is in keeping with the horror theme, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a very practical way of getting rid of stuff.
Yeah, it's very good. But yeah, so I think you're right. They the music is a bit heavy-handed. That was more about the style, the approach to filmmaking in the 70s. So that's one of the sort of triggers that could date it. You think, oh, well, that's definitely the 70s, but, you know, I suppose I could look upon that and say, right, that's what makes it what it is, that it's the time capsule, you know. And it's great to see London, because he was a diplomat, wasn't he, that got posted to London. So it's great to see London in the 70s. So
that does I thought that too. I thought it looked great, and obviously they're out and about filming in real locations, so that was good. There's a lot to The Omen that I enjoyed. I just felt that there will definitely be an audience of people who are used to these sort of possession style films, like Hereditary and The Witch, that they'll watch this and go, oh, okay, like, it does feel dated in some ways. But I also do feel that as a precursor to a lot of those films, and also some of the stuff that Edgar Wright has done. If you watch some of Edgar Wright's films,
oh, absolutely,
there's a bit in this where something falls off the roof of the church and it impales someone. I was like, that is literally from Hot Fuzz. Like, Hot Fuzz has obviously referenced that. And I think that a lot of these filmmakers that are making modern horrors or modern films like that will have use this as a touch point, and I think that's good.
It's the big daddy. It's the big daddy of horror movies, because you know, they'll look at that and they think, right, because there are only so many ways you can do something. And a visual trick, a storyline, it's got to be done the first time, right? It's done the first time, then other filmmakers will refine it, they'll adapt it, they'll update it. And someone like Edgar Wright will pay tribute, will name check those films if you look closely. And it's very subtle. It's, you know, some directors are very good at it. And they'll put a subtle nod in to a film that was made maybe 40 or 50 years ago. You know, the likes of Scorsese and Coppola and Spielberg have made careers out of drawing on classic movies from the 50s and 60s. So, you know, everything is derivative. You know, you really need to look hard to find the originals, the source of the films that we see today. But that's the way of the world. That's how you do it. You know, and that's the, you know, we've got the fun part of it, haven't we? We can watch and pick it all up.
And pick it all apart, which is what
and pick it all apart as well, yeah.
So that's The Omen, and as I said earlier, available on Disney Plus if you want to watch it. I believe the next one's on there, so that's where I'll be watching that.
Yeah, I'll have to do that as well.
See, you know, you kind of think, well, actually, I've started now, so I may as well.
You might as well finish. Yeah, carry on. Only right.
So, if you have any scary films that you want to let us know that you've watched and are great, do send in your reviews. We'll happily play them on this show. But that is it for this quite bumper-packed episode. We've gone through a lot. 6 indie films there, as well as the 2 cinema films, the streaming release, and a nostalgia pick. I mean, you get all this free in your ears. So,
What more could you ask for? Luxury.
Luxury. next month will be our November episode going into December, so it may be we get a bit festive. We might get festive the next
episode.
Why not?
Yeah. That's a bit of a teaser there, Chris. You're tormenting them, aren't you?
Yep. So if you want to send us your recommendations for the best Christmas film, and maybe that will be our nostalgia pick. We also have a couple of films already submitted from indie filmmakers for that episode too. So this has been UK Film Club, part of the UK Film Review podcast. I have been your host, Chris Olsen, and Brian Penn, as always, has been my lovely assistant. I'll say lovely assistant, not just assistant.
Thank you very much.
My lovely assistant. But he doesn't wear the costumes that I buy him.
No. I've got a draw line somewhere, honestly. Really, pleasure as always.
Pleasure as always. Thank you for joining us, and thank you if you have stuck all the way to the end. You are a real trooper. But that's it for now.
Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.